Hustle. The book is Knocking the Hustle, Against the Neoliberal Turn in Black Politics. Dr. Lester K. Spence, professor at Johns Hopkins University, Center for Major Media, Scholar in Residence. Good to have you here, brother.
What up, Doe? What up, Doe? It's good to be here.
We play that in honor of your book.
Let's go.
410-319-8888 is the number. You can write to us here at talkatsteinershow.org by email. You can tweet us at Mark Steiner, go on our Facebook pages, do call in as you hear the conversation unfold. 410-319-8888. Hustle Hard, Ace Hood. Well, that in part was the title of the book, but let me before we get into the title of the book, mm-hmm. Let's get into the title of the book first, and then I'm going to come back to a piece at the very beginning of the book.
Yeah, yeah.
So the Knocking the Hustle. Let's define the hustle as you see it.
Yeah. Yeah, so I start out the book actually talking about Ace Hood, that song. And that video is really important. If you see the video, it has Ace Hood in kind of a stereotypical city. He's standing still, and there's all this stuff happening around him. And the seasons change, but he stays the same, and he's consistently on his hustle,
right.
Selling stuff, selling this, selling that. Now, back in the day, when I was younger, when you were younger, like my dad, like maybe 20, 30 years ago, somebody who hustled was somebody who was always trying to get out of work,
right?
Or doing illegal activity, trying to kind of cut corners, right? But somewhere around, and actually there's an interesting project in this alone, somewhere around the 90s or so maybe, the term actually changes, where instead of somebody who's trying to get out of work, it's somebody who's consistently working. Right. And it's not just a description of their behavior. They're consistently working. And I'm not just talking about illegal activity. I'm talking about people having 2-3 jobs, et cetera, two, three legal jobs. It's that not just a description of their work. It's a normative statement about what people should do. Right. That is, what you should be doing is hustling. What you should be doing is taking more and more responsibility for the stuff around you. And what that does is it creates the kind of common sense that then creates a political and economic apparatus that makes really, really strong distinctions between people who are able to hustle in a certain way and people who aren't, right? And then people who are able to hustle are given resources, and people who aren't able to hustle are either taught to hustle or they're basically discarded, right? So what I'm doing is I'm in effect knocking that concept. In hip hop, people talk about you can't knock my hustle, right? Can't knock the hustle. Jay-Z talks about that. No, I'm knocking that hustle. I believe that hustle, it generates significant levels of economic inequality, significant levels of racial inequality, and it basically reduces, it kills the very concept of a public good. As an aside, I want to give a shout out to William, who drove me here in Uber. He used to work at the Parks and Recs. You didn't think I shot you out, did you? He used to work at the Parks and Recs in Baltimore, in Curtis Bay. And one of the things that happens in a city like Baltimore is it starts to privatize a range of public services. They start to privatize the parks and rec centers, and next thing you know, that whole concept of recreation being free dissolves, right? And to the extent that people are working in parks and recs, they're now trying to think about how to make their recreation centers like private providers as opposed to public goods for the kids, and it's horrible.
It is, and you point that out later in some of the stuff in the book, which I thought some interesting statistics about police and rec centers in our history, which I found really interesting. And I was thinking about, yeah, it is different. Back in the day, when you talk about hustle, people, I mean, the people used to say you have to have your gig and you have to have your hustle.
Yep. Yes.
But now it's all you have to have your hustle to survive.
That's it, to survive, right? Not just to get extra stuff.
Right. So you also, in the very beginning of this book, before you even get into the book, on the inside of the book, and you say that the work belongs to other people because you are into creating public sphere, you're creating this public commons, this book is open. Now, what's that philosophy? It's not like something you did as kind of a pragmatic philosophical look at how this work should be taken.
Yeah, so I was looking at the when I was thinking about publishers, right? I wasn't interested in getting, you know, you can write a book like this now and actually get paid. You can write a book like this and get an advance big enough to put your kid through school if you're somebody like a, you know, if you're somebody with a much bigger name than mine. But even in my case, you know, I could have probably sold this book to a nice press, had a nice advance, you know, the paid speaking tour, et cetera, et cetera. But I wasn't about that. It wasn't just about me. What I wanted to see was whether I could take a book like this and spread the ideas out in order to create a wider conversation through which a better sense of politics could come. So I went with Punctum because I'd heard about them, and they had a really interesting model where they published a book. You could get a book like Mark, for those of you who don't know, Mark has a hard copy of the book in his hands. But you could also get like a PDF or a digital copy like for free, right? And I wanted people to be able to read the book. And if people didn't have the loot to pay the hard copy, they could just get the book for free, right? Now, the thing is, there are some challenges with that model, right? That in as much as Punctum and Eileen Joy, shout out to Eileen Joy, she is dope. She's doing a lot of work into it, but I don't necessarily have the money for the speaking tour, right? There are spaces, like there are spaces, as you noted, he said this, he was like, I would never say this publicly, but I'm going to actually put it out there. It's not actually as edited as perfectly as a book that was with a mainstream press would be edited. It's just not, because it's kind of a small shop. Right?
Right.
But I thought it was more important to have like a 95% edited book go with a small shop where the ideas could be distributed for free that can extend the idea or that can support independent presses than something, a different type of project.
So let's get into some of the heart of this book. So I think it's a very important book. There are a couple books out right now along with yours, I think, are really critical. This is one of the most critical, I think. And I wanted to find some terms here, as we do with The Hustle. And you talk early on about, let's examine what this neoliberal turn is, and let's examine it in terms of what you mean by human capital, mm-hmm. which is part of that definition.
Oh, wow. That's the exit. So when people used to study, when economists used to study labor, right, they treated labor as a fixed good, as a fixed entity, right? Maybe it was a fixed number. And what a set of economists out of Chicago, Gary Becker out of Chicago, did, he kind of revolutionized that concept, right? He was like, well, you know what? It's not labor. You're missing. There is labor involved, but you're missing that human beings actually have the capacity to work on themselves and kind of develop themselves, right? So he used the concept of human capital in order to kind of talk about that development process. Now, once you actually develop the concept of human capital, you're able to explain a wide range of phenomena that you couldn't quite explain before, right? So countries, there was a question about why certain countries were successful and certain countries weren't, you know, putting the politics of colonialism, et cetera, to the side. And the concept of human capital allowed them to explain how countries with a certain type of infrastructure could have significantly higher GDP, even given than countries that didn't, right? So, and there's some other stuff you can explain by that. But more importantly, for the purpose of this book, what that does is it kind of translates, it enables economists to study a wide range of human activity and put it under the purview of economics. And then that in turn allows people to think of human beings primarily of entrepreneurs of themselves. And once you embed that idea that human beings are in effect entrepreneurs of themselves, then that allows a wide range of neoliberal policy, what I call neoliberal policies, to end up developing. And these policies have horrible, horrible, horrible consequences in general.
People use this word neoliberalism a lot, but I don't think many people, even when they use the word, understand the depth of the word.
Yes.
Not because people aren't are stupid, but because we just these words come into our common nomenclature and we just use them all the time, right?
Yeah, that's right. That's right.
So, but I think that there's some really hard definitions here of what these mean. I want to get to that, but let me get it to this way, because you take on something in different parts of this book and take on a certain philosophy in this part of in different parts of your book and end up with it as well. One of the iconic figures in radical politics, in the black movement, someone who is attacked a great deal for his attacks on Barack Obama and is lauded by many activists, is Cornel West. And one of the things you talk about here in this book a lot in different ways is challenging Cornel West, which you apparently did when you met him, as you write about in the book, mm-hmm. Around this idea of the prophetic vision as opposed to prophetic power as opposed to seizing power.
Yes.
And there's a real difference of how you see the world and what the whole role of public intellectuals has been.
Oh, yes.
Right? So
yes.
Why don't you take off on that for a minute?
Yeah. Yeah, you're going to get me heated.
I think this is really at the heart of a lot of stuff, at least on the, there's other stuff we're going to get into, but I think this is part of the heart of it.
Yeah, and this is one of the things. So I wrote the book against, to a certain extent, against Race Matters, which Cornel West wrote. It was both a I used Race Matters, which Cornel West wrote in early 90s, right, as a model, and that it was a short book, contained a lot of ideas. My book is kind of short, contains a lot of ideas. But intellectually, I wanted to write against it in two different ways. One way is I want to write against the idea that black people are kind of broken and our biggest problem is cultural dysfunction. And Cornel probably wouldn't say that's what his book is about, but it is. But the second thing I wanted to write against was this idea of that black people, that black elites, black leaders, whether it's prophetic people who speak truth to power, or it's or it's other people like them, that is there primarily. That is there's this concept called noblesse oblige.
Right.
Right. Noblesse oblige basically means that those who have power, who have status, have the responsibility to basically pull everybody else up, right? And that concept kind of is deeply anti-democratic, right? That is, it ignores the possibility that people in general have the capacity to wield political speech, that have the capacity to actually hold and wield political power. And it puts all this weight on these elites as if they actually know what they're doing, right? And they don't. And as if they don't have their own interests, which they do, right? So every time somebody like Cornel West, and it's funny because I am a kind of public intellectual in Baltimore. Every time people look at somebody like me or somebody like Cornel West and look at us as speaking truth to power as if that's the solution, what they're doing is basically saying that black people in places like Baltimore don't have the ability, and in some ways not even the right, to actually kind of fight for themselves or the capacity to fight for themselves. And I find that incredibly distasteful.
Well, to me, I mean, a part of it, though, is you, in different parts of the book, you also challenge Du Bois. And the talented tenth.
The whole talented tenth idea.
Even though you point out in the book that he gave up the notion of talented tenth, mm-hmm. but still had similar ideas in a different framework. But the idea that when you talk towards the end of the book about Rosa Parks and the movement in Birmingham, and using the way that Cornel West and others would look at the prophetic vision of Dr. King as being the substance of that movement. Me feeds into this, this argument, right? But that something very different should be looked at in terms of what Rosa Parks really has to say, and so
basically, what I do in that chapter where I take on Cornel West explicitly, I do so in other places implicitly. What I do is I look at that bus boycott, right? And the story everybody knows, the common sense story, is that Rosa Parks was tired, the seamstress who was tired, just didn't feel like getting up. They put her in the joint, and all of a sudden everybody got up and organized and said, we're going to fight for Rosa, and et cetera, et cetera. But if you really look at the story, it's far richer, right? So Rosa Parks had a long history as a political activist. In fact, she was trained in part by working with and under Ella Baker and others like her.
At the Highlander Center.
And at the Highlander Center in Tennessee, right? She wasn't the first person to actually do this. There was a women's political council that she was a part of. I think that was the name of the organization. So there are this large institutional infrastructure that was designed to actually push this issue. And Martin Luther King Jr. was at least at the outset, just the guy whose church they used, right? But then it became really clear that he had this power to speak. Right. But the thing is that bus boycott lasted for 381 days. It wasn't King's ability to speak that actually allowed that bus boycott to last.
Even he says that.
And you
say that in the book. Even he says
even that. Even he says that. Right. I mean, so there's this passage in the book, the passage from him, I'll quote, where they're getting it. They're calling him every hour of the night. They're bringing in so much money that he can't even count it. They need an institutional infrastructure to count the money, to create the system where people can be picked up, to organize that, to organize, you know, how people would protest. They needed an institutional infrastructure. It wasn't him speaking truth to power, right? That institutional development requires regular folk problem solving, right? Yeah, he could speak. Right. Ella Baker could speak, but it was that institutional infrastructure. It was people fighting amongst themselves, trying to find a way out of no way. It was that. It wasn't speaking truth to power that got them that developed the civil rights movement. That was a part of it, but it wasn't that. And every time we articulate a politics that suggests it is, we send people backwards rather than forwards.
And one of the things I thought about as you wrote that piece, you talk about Jean Theo Harris's book,
yes,
on Rosa, which, you know, I interviewed her about that book, which I thought was an incredible piece of work. She's a great historian, interesting writer.
Mm-hmm.
But and you write about how when the bus boycott happened in Montgomery, that they had to organize the black cab drivers and other people to pick up and coordinate people's schedules and get people and the problems inside of that between people arguing in the cabs and everything, how they're going to get to work and who's going to get paid and how they're going to get the money together to do that and all the rest.
Yes.
What it says to me is, and I kept thinking about this a lot when we talk about looking at what happens in Baltimore and other places after Garner was murdered and after what happened in Baltimore and the uprising that happened in Baltimore and all the rest in Ferguson. And people demonstrated in March, which was really very powerful, powerful moment in Baltimore. But it's the organizing is what you're talking about. It's going after and building a different kind of structure that has something that has – builds models, as you talk about later in the book, are difficult to even build and sustain, no matter how good they are. But yes, that's part – what's the part?
I'm making a stark distinction between activism and organizing, a stark distinction. Now, in general, you know, if we're just talking about kind of traditional politics, in a way, we can say activism and organizing are part of the same kind of category of actions or whatever. But in the book, I'm making a stark distinction between activism and organizing. Right? Organizing is about building people's capacity to govern, and it's about developing institutional apparatuses that people themselves run. Activism is a series of mobilizing people largely for direct action projects, but very rarely do they in and of themselves develop really sustainable alternatives, really sustainable critiques of the status quo. And to the extent, again, if you think about that Cornel West move, there's a reason why every time we see him, we usually see him at direct actions. And I'm using Cornel West, but I can easily be swapping out a range of other figures. Cornel West just becomes the easy person to kind of talk about. But there's a reason why you see him primarily at direct actions, right? Because for him, that's where the stuff is. But that's not empirically and politically, we know that's not where the stuff is. That's not how to contest the neoliberal turn. That's not what we need to do to advance the contemporary, you know, advance where we are.
That would be very critical, and we're going to come to that. There's two things I think is really important to parse out, and I think that when I get into the, we really have to spend some time here defining what neoliberalism, how neoliberalism came to be, and what it actually has done around the three pillars you talk about in terms of church and family and education and
the city
and city's infrastructures and how around cities and how that's changed over the last 40 years and what's that done, what that's done. So, but there's also distinction, just to parse that, just to finish it out, between the difference between organizing and mobilizing. I mean, that is at the heart of what your critique is, and this particular part of, of your critique.
Yes. You know what? So there are going to be viewers who don't know what neoliberalism is. But so
let's,
Yeah, let me quickly define it. So what neoliberalism is, it's a three – so it's a basically a three-pronged thing, right? It's a – for one, it's kind of a – it's a class project designed to take resources from people without from people with little resources and to kind of distribute them upward to people who already have resources, right? So it's a class project. But second – and then it's also kind of a political project – designed to kind of develop, designed to get governments at every level to embed a certain a set of policies that basically privatize public goods, that basically significantly diminish the government's ability to provide provide kind of what we think of as a welfare state, and significantly reduce taxes on the wealthy. And then there's also a heavy policing component also that comes both domestically and internationally. And then third, though, is this cultural project designed to kind of get people to think of themselves, get people, institutions, and a wide range of actors to think of themselves as business in entrepreneurial terms. So the hip hop phrase that best describes this is Jay-Z's phrase in Kanye West's Diamonds from Sierra Leone. I'm not a businessman. I'm a businessman. That is, you know, it, in that case, he's not just a business person. He actually views himself as a business, as a brand, right? And we see that happening in a number of different spaces, where whether it's the church, whether it's education, whether it's nonprofits, where people, where this entrepreneurial language, this entrepreneurial ethos has invaded it.
So if you take these pieces out, and I've been thinking about early in the book when you talk about Clinton, and you know people laud him, as you wrote about it, for the empowerment zones that he created, and people laud him for that, but at the same time he was signing the Violent Crime Control Act.
Yes.
And Reagan couldn't get it done, but Clinton got it done.
Yep.
And the money he spent to support new prisons and taking Pell Grants away from inmates and changing the nature, really altering things. I mean, this was amazing. It's been turning for decades, but actually, in some ways, the Clinton administration was the real turn in neoliberal politics.
Oh yes. People have been trying to roll back AFDC, for example, to what we think of as welfare. People are trying to roll back welfare for decades. It was Clinton that did it, right? To take a lifetime right. Right. Whereas if you were a single mother and you were on hard times, you had a lifetime right to benefits to take care of your kid. And he basically repealed that.
And let me just throw something in here. It wasn't necessarily in your book, but it made me think of the conversation I had with Joanne Reed a few weeks back at the library that we played on the air here from MSNBC, who I think is a brilliant mind. Mm-hmm. But she said about Clinton, yeah, he did that when I raised that to her on the panel. But what he did was say to black leaders across America – in cities, you say your crime is bad in your communities. We're doing this. We're going to lock some people up. We're going to change the nature of policing and build prisons. But I'm also giving you this money so you can build this rec center, so you can create an empowerment zone, so you can have this stuff in your community, and that's the payoff.
Yeah, but the thing is that even that dynamic was neoliberal, right? So one of the things that neoliberalism does is it embeds the idea of competition, right? Because that's how businesses are supposed to grow. It embeds the idea of competition into every aspect of life. So what you have happen with grants to cities is what cities used to be able to get back in like the late 60s because of LBJ. Cities would pay a certain amount of their money out in taxes, and then they would get it directly back in the federal government, and then they'd be able to use that money to provide social services. What basically happens is that the amount of that money gets cut, And then Reagan ends up basically kind of gutting it, right? Where at best what you had were cities competing with one another, right? So Bill Clinton comes up with this empowerment zone idea. It was an idea that was developed by a Republican, by kind of a liberal Republican, Jack Kemp. Enterprise zones. He changes to empowerment zones. And what it basically has is cities competing over this small pool of resources.
Like you're doing with education right now.
Yep. And
race to the top.
Right, exactly. End up being race to the bottom. So, and in order to get the money, cities had to come up with public-private partnerships. Another key aspect of the neoliberal turn, where they actually had to develop partnerships between foundations, between businesses, and between political officials. So it ends up creating these spaces that are primed for the neoliberal turn.
So we have to take a short break here. When we come back, though, I want to say to address the issue of people would say, so what? That's the world we live in. We've got to survive in this world. That's if that neoliberal term means more resources for black communities in a time when there's not going to be any, that's important. We'll kind of come back to that.
Yeah.
And redefining what neoliberalism means, but looking at solutions, Lester Spence puts in his book, Knocking the Hustle Against the Neoliberal Turn in Black Politics. Join us at 410-319-8888. We'll be right back. Welcome back. This is Mark Steiner. I want to remind you all that this coming that on Wednesday, March the 10th, from 7 to 9:30 p.m., we'll be hosting a mayoral debate coming up here at Morgan State University and with our partners at City Paper, WEAA. And the theme of the event is Ask, Listen, Vote, Solutions and Strategies for the Future. It's open to the public. We'll have the debate. Will be aired live on WEA. Residents can engage moderators and candidates via Twitter through the recently launched @BaltimoreDebate using #BaltimoreDebates. So go to WEAA.org for more information. You can RSVP at BaltimoreMayoralDebate.eventbrite.com or just show up. Join us there March the 10th, 7 p.m. here at Morgan State University at the Murphy Fine Arts Center for our debate with the Democratic candidates running for mayor of Baltimore coming up on March the 10th. Back here to Knocking the Hustle with Lester Spence, Dr. Lester K. Spence, of course, assistant professor of political science and Africana studies at Johns Hopkins University, Center for Emerging Media's scholar in residence, wrote this really incredibly easy to read, well-written book, as I wrote to him the other night as I was reading it. Do join us here as you're hearing what he's saying and throw your thoughts into the conversation at 410-319-8888. So, Lester, I mean, I really, this is I want to get into the heart of what neoliberalism, from your political analysis, mm-hmm. has done in the four critical areas you talk about with cities.
Yeah.
And in the areas that directly affect the black community.
Those four areas.
Yeah. Talk a bit about that. To define, I think it's more to set these definitions up.
Yeah, okay. So what happens in cities, right, in cities with large black population, well, in cities in general, is that they're forced to become more and more entrepreneurial. So in policy, we see an increase in a significant focus on downtown development. We see a significant focus on policing. When we see black political officials involved, we see this kind of cultural rhetoric actually attached to it, where they're specifically speaking down to black poor populations, articulating that, you know, suggesting that they're kind of responsible for the condition of their city and they're responsible for their own condition. We see the privatization. We see a number of public goods privatized, whether it's parks and recs, like we talked about. Again, shout out to William, or other, you know, other forms in the city. We see increasing use of nonprofits and businesses to kind of piece off, right? So I think I forgot one of the mayoral candidates is actually suggesting that in exchange for tax write-offs, businesses build recreation centers.
Right. Warnock said that.
Warnock said that. Right. Yeah. And everybody's like, wow, that's a great idea. But what that basically is doing is kind of parsing off that public responsibility, is giving a business a tax write-off where business should be paying in to the public good. And it's kind of privatizing that function. right? As far as education, what we see is we see privatization, or if not privatization explicitly, we see kind of the use of market initiatives. You know, education right. becomes marketized, whether it's through vouchers, through the creation of charter schools. We see education institutions kind of adopt business-like metrics in determining educational outcomes. The purpose of education ends up being about getting a job rather than governing. So that we see that shift. And then in the family, we see significant pressures placed on families. I begin the book talking about those pressures on my own family. Right. And here I am. I'm a professional. I'm making a good chunk of loot at Hopkins. But there's a great deal of stress placed on me and my family to take care of all these responsibilities. Right. So we're all this incredible load is placed on us, and we end up having to hustle our way out of it and then blaming ourselves when things don't go the way that they should. In churches, we see this in the growth and spread of the prosperity gospel in Black communities. And to be fair, all these dynamics are dynamics that happen in general, broadly. Black people aren't the only ones who follow the prosperity gospel. In fact, there are versions of the prosperity gospel in other religions, right? Whether it be Islam or Buddhism, there are other versions of it. But what basically happens with prosperity gospel is the Bible's turned into an entrepreneurial self-help guide. And mega churches develop that look more like corporations than churches. All these dynamics, what they basically do is they counter mobilize Black people. They mobilize black energy, but instead of being mobilized towards public projects, toward collective action, towards a certain type of progressive politics, it's mobilized towards this private dynamic, this private personal development project and this private kind of castigation project because there are people who can become entrepreneurial, but then there are people who can't. And the people who can't have to kind of be cordoned off and have to basically have a foot placed on their neck so they don't affect everybody else.
Right. And so we also end up teaching entrepreneurship in schools as if it's the way out of
the only way out. Yeah. Yeah. So imagination thing is really important, right? So the book for me is a way to get a certain set of ideas out. I mean, because that's what I do. I'm an idea person. And with the belief that ideas themselves can kind of change the world, right? But what happens with the neoliberal turn is all of our ideas end up going towards the entrepreneurial, right? Our common sense, or that our ideational universe, so to speak, is all about entrepreneurial solutions to public problems. And we can't even think about the possibility of things outside of that entrepreneurial ethos.
So 410-319-8888, here with Dr. Lester Spence talking about his book, Knocking the Hustle Against the Neoliberal Turn in Black Politics. 410-319-8888. Write to us here at talk@steinershow.org. 410-319-8888. Tim, in Baltimore, you're on the air. Welcome.
How you doing, Mark?
Very well. Good morning.
Good. Yeah, one of the things I want to ask is you speak about neoliberalism and, you know, privatizing a lot of different aspects of city services and things that municipalities are generally in charge of and the role they play in cities. What is another alternative? My experience has been working typically with nonprofit organizations that are sort of that conduit between public and private sector to get things done in cities. And it's been my experience that while government does bring a certain level of responsibility and understanding the weight of some of the decisions, the private sector does a lot better as far as executing on things. I don't see an alternative to just turning it over either way, because there needs to be checks and balances, turn cities, communities around without having that certain level of entrepreneurship in there, in the mix.
Tim, that's a great question.
Great question.
Can I ask you, when you say you see private, in your experience, the private sector does a better job of execution, could you talk about a sector where you've seen that?
For instance, real estate development. If you look at urban renewal projects, if you look at a lot of building of even public infrastructure, you know, things like that. They typically bring the private sector in. They let the contracts for the private sector to come in, those with the expertise to actually deliver those services, but it's under the guidance of the public eye, so to speak.
Right. Thank you for developing, and that's a great question. So one alternative would be to kind of – so the challenge with introducing either private actors or nonprofit actors is they're not democratically accountable. Now, you can argue that they're indirectly democratically accountable, in as much as if they engage in a contract with the city and the city can say, okay, well, we need you to do X, Y, and Z. If you don't do X, Y, and Z, then then we're going to take back your contract or renegotiate. But usually even that indirect mode doesn't work. So what you end up having are basically private interests, twofold private interests through the private developers. But then nonprofits themselves are actually governed by kind of private actors. Maybe they have a board, right? But that board of nonprofit actors usually aren't held accountable to the citizens. So even if you have perfect execution, and I think real estate is probably the one example where you may see good execution. But the reason you see good execution is because real estate has kind of been privatized. Like land is kind of the private good, right? But even when you see that, what you see the outcomes as far as being democratically equitable, those outcomes are very, very rarely democratically equitable. So one moderate solution would be to increase democratic control over private decisions and over decisions of nonprofit entities.
So if you take what Tim is asking you and we move to later on in your book for a moment and you try to wrestle with ideas that might work and you also have critiques of those ideas at mm-hmm. the same time. So we've done a little bit in defining this, the concept of neoliberalism, which we can another day come back to in a deeper way, because I think the conversation is important to understand what that means. But you spend your time talking a lot about the three pillars, Chakwe Lumumba, the things that he was putting out before he died, and other issues around that. So let me talk about these solutions that you talk about, what you see as a way to people to wrestle with a different idea of how society can be constructed.
Right. So another way to think about that, and thank you, and again, thank you, Tim. That's a brilliant way to a brilliant question, and you causing me to think about some stuff I'm not sure I'd have gotten to in the show.
You want to say anything else about that before you do this?
Well, the Lumumba example is perfect, right? Now, first, well, I'll talk about the example, and then the how we get there. Is another critique.
And very quickly, who Chakwe was? People might not know who Chakwe.
Yeah, so Chakwe Lumumba was a black national, a radical black nationalist out of Detroit. Got to give shout outs to Detroit whenever I can. He ends up being elected to the city council in Jackson, Mississippi, and then ends up running for mayor and winning under, basically part of the Malcolm X grassroots movement, which has cells basically all over the country. And the Malcolm X grassroots movement actually kind of created this whole, not created, but one of the things that they adopted was this series of kind of alternative economic institutions, right? So they talked about, they really placed a really strong emphasis on not just local businesses, but local cooperatively owned businesses, right? So one of the things that Tim is kind of bringing up is the idea that municipalities aren't quite nimble enough and aren't quite innovative enough maybe and don't quite have the expertise to engage in certain activities. Well, if you took democratically owned businesses and had them do the development work, right? So, for example, a cooperatively owned business in Sandtown, Winchester, when Freddie Gray was killed, right? You'd actually increase the capacity of people to make decisions for their own land, increase the capacity of people to provide for themselves, right? And you create an economy that actually can scale, that's at the appropriate scale, right? So by taking over city government, and he died very, very soon after he was elected.
Yeah.
Yeah, and then his son, ran in the runoff, and his son lost. So you know, there's a question as to where they go from here. But that idea that you have these other institutions outside of government but are themselves kind of democratically run by the people can radically reimagine how cities function and can generate another, can create another space from which to think about how innovation occurs and how cities grow and thrive.
Now, the stumbling block here is when you write about, when you talk about neoliberal turn in politics, the role that the new economy is playing in cities vis-a-vis bonds and bond ratings, which we've talked about with the mayor and ad nauseum on this program. But it becomes a centerpiece to why the turn cities have taken and how they develop.
Yeah, so real quickly, so once that turn happens and cities can't really get loot from the federal government anymore, they begin to rely more and more on floating bonds as a way to get their loot. And when you float bonds in a market, you know, you've got bonds that are really high investment grade bonds and you've got bonds that are low investment grade bonds. High investment grade bonds get a lot of investment and low investment grade bonds don't. And what happens is the decision, like bond rating agencies end up evaluating the quality of your bond, right? So what type of things, how do they, and they're not Democrat, they're not elected, they're not accountable at all to anybody except their investors, right? Or they're the people who have stock in them. How do they make their decisions? Cities that do more downtown development actually have a higher bond rating,
like
right?
Like Baltimore,
right? So that ends up structuring the decisions that political officials feel they have to make in order to remain solvent and in order to provide services, what services they do provide. And that dynamic ends up placing kind of a box around the types of things they think that they can do. And that ends up leading to more downtown development. Again, that leads to more policing because you've got this population of people that aren't really fit for the economy, right? So you have to kind of police them more. That leads to kind of, to the extent you have tax policy, that tax policy ends up being about tax breaks, about tax income, you know, about TIFs, you know, which is a big thing in Baltimore now. And we know the end result of all those practices is increased inequality.
So what's interesting to me is I was reading the book, I was putting this little chart together in my head about neoliberal politics.
Mm-hmm.
And I was thinking about how we took away from 1960, the late 60s through Reagan and Clinton and the Bushes and even Obama, we took away more and more money, like for housing, and took money and put money into other places. So we create this world where now instead of having federal money coming in to work in cities, you've got nonprofit foundations, public-private partnerships, and these bonds that are issued, that people put out, that people vote on, or people they float for cities to build. That's changed the entire nature of how a community is run.
Yeah.
The question is there an answer to that?
Yeah. So the answer that I'm pushing is it gets back to, and this gets, you know, is gets back to kind of how Chokwe was elected. The short-term answer is kind of political organizing, right? That is, we have to organize populations, working class. And to be fair, they're already organized. We're not talking about populations that aren't organized. Black folk already organized, but they have to kind of be reorganized in favor of kind of a political project. Right, a progressive political project. So in the book, I talk about the example of the Chicago Teachers Union. I kind of cheat with that example.
That's a really good example, though.
Yeah, it is. I kind of cheat with it because the book is about black politics. The Chicago Teachers Union isn't all black. But the Chicago Teachers Union, because of legislation, in order to strike, the Chicago Teachers Union needed like a 90% vote of all members. Not like a 90% vote of people who are at a meeting, but a 90% vote of all members. And that's a large teachers union. And what they did was they, over the course of years, built support to the point where they got that 90% vote. and they organized, not successfully necessarily, but they organized for more resources. Chicago closed a number of schools because they're trying to implement, you know, they're trying to basically privatize their schools and explode charters. They've closed a number of schools where teachers organize with parents against that. The whole idea is that we have to organize populations in favor of basically taking control of as many different spaces as many different spaces that govern them as possible, and then in the course of doing that, promote these radical alternatives that basically return democratic control to citizens. That's basically what it looks like. That's basically the theoretical idea behind it. What it looks like specifically, it depends on the circumstance.
I mean, so you know, the idea of speaking truth to power. I was thinking about that because I use that term a lot because I'm on that radio. So it becomes a sense of what that means on the air, because that's what we do on the air. You speak truth to power because there's shows that you do. But you need to, you're saying you have to take that beyond the idea of that as being a political tool and creating a different tool that answers the questions, that pushes the idea.
Yeah, we have to get beyond this me, you know, me speaking truth and embedding this, you know, me making this critique. I mean, which I do. Again, I do this stuff. But we have to get back to organizing, doing the really, really hard organizing work to give regular people the capacity to use and wield political speech. Right. So somebody who's been on your show a lot and actually I think she's running for office now is somebody like Kim Trueheart. Mm-hmm. Right. Now, Kim Trueheart, to be fair, she is not a regular person. Kim Trueheart is absolutely dope. But just using her as kind of a placeholder, just like I use Cornel West. Just imagine if regular retirees, and Baltimore's got a lot of them. I mean, the guy who picked me up, William, is a retiree. If they all had the capacity to wield political speech, to go to that board of estimate meetings like she goes to and says, you know what? No, what you're doing here isn't right. Where she knows the board of estimate stuff better than city council members do, right? What do we have to do that? Now, that's a lot of hard work. And that's a lot harder than making a nice speech that everybody says, oh, my God, you're so articulate, right? That's a lot harder, and that requires a lot of long-term planning and actually a lot of losses before victories come. But that's the only way to do it.
So, I mean, like here in Baltimore, you've got people who I know pretty well who's doing incredible organizing work, John Comer and Neighbors United in the housing projects in Baltimore City. And organizing people in those places, people like Jessica Lewis organizing and the Right to Housing Alliance.
Yes.
I mean, so those are kind of core organizations that have a core to them.
Yes.
But you're also saying that it has to go beyond just organizing to protest.
Yes, yes.
It's organized to build alternatives.
To build alternatives. Organizing to build alternatives, right? So you think about the work that somebody like Dorcas Gilmore is doing.
Right.
With
right.
A black
the attorney.
With the idea of black worker, trying to develop capacity for black worker centers, right? It's about promoting alternatives. And it's about building membership-based organizations and then developing radical alternatives.
So in cities like Baltimore, which is 60, well, we're almost out of time, unfortunately. We have to do another episode too.
Yeah, you know. You know how we get down.
So in a city like Baltimore, where 63% of the population is African American, and well over three quarters of that black population in Baltimore lives in poverty or surrounded by it, if not more than that. But you also have a growing Latino population, and you have an Asian population, and you got white people here too.
Every now and then.
So can the political organizing response be built, and this is a big argument people have in this program all the time, be built slowly on the black community?
Well, here's the question. So somebody like Adolf would say no. And Adolf Reed. And somebody like Adolf Reed would also say that poor folk, to the extent they should be organized, we shouldn't be talking about them. We should be focusing primarily in the workplace. What that approach ignores is that even Marx talked about kind of a point of production and a point of consumption. That is, it's not about just organizing where people work. It's about organizing kind of where people live. And to the extent that Baltimore is characterized by high levels of segregation, of housing segregation by race and class, then first we're talking about organizing people. If we're talking about point of consumption stuff, We're talking about organizing people where they live. So what that's going to look like is folks in Essex and Dundalk organizing on their behalf. That's going to be primarily a white working class organizing project. Latino populations, I believe they're concentrated in the Highland Town area. And around Hopkins, around the medical school, they organizing on their behalf, and then black working class folk organizing on their behalf. But then after that, coming together, right? So it's a both and. It's not an either or. Anybody who articulates it as an either or doesn't really understand what we're dealing with in cities like Baltimore. And I actually include Adolph Reed is a big time intellectual mentor of mine, and I know him personally. He's a good guy. But I think he's wrong here. What we're talking about is a both and project.
So I mean the idea here, if you could, in the last few minutes we have left, if you could sum up, 90 seconds all I have, sum up what neoliberalism, the effect it's had, and where you would take it from here.
So in black politics, neoliberalism is basically created a project where black elites basically take resources from black poor, claiming that it's on behalf of black people. Black elites have consistently created a rhetoric that destabilizes the idea of the public in black people's minds, and it's up to black poor and working class folk and the folk who care about black poor and working class folk to kind of fight for this. As an aside, I'm actually going to be talking about this. About this tomorrow. Leaders of Beautiful Struggle, a group of young brothers I really have a great deal of appreciation for. They're going
to
have me at the Real News Network. 6 to 8 p.m. tomorrow. Come down, come through. I'd love to see WEAA's audience there. We already had one event at Red Emma's. It was so packed. It was like it was standing room only outside. I'd love to see my WEAA folk to come up.
231 Holiday Street. More information at lbsbaltimore.org. 6 to 8 p.m. tomorrow night at the Real News Network at 231 Holiday Street. Lester Spence will be speaking as a guest of the Leaders of Beautiful Struggle, talking about his book, Knocking the Hustle Against the Neoliberal Turn in Black Politics. Lester, thanks so much for being here.
No, thank you. This book could not have happened without you, without the staff at WEAA. The bass man walked in a second ago, shouts out. This book could not have happened without you guys. I love you. Thank you.
Love you all too. All right, take a short break. Time for sound bites. Yes, chickens. We'll be right back.